Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. I am thrilled, honored, excited today because it's a very special day. For the very first time, I am doing a writer of nonfiction whose writing is so beautiful and so conceptually strange that I felt entranced by him. And then I saw his work. He's an artist. He's a potter. He has an exhibit in the Gagosian Gallery that people in Los Angeles can go and see. And what he's done in a first book is to trace the background, the history of an inheritance, a set of Netsukis that survived the Holocaust and were in the possession of an uncle, Iggy, in Japan, whose partner survived Uncle Iggy and helped follow the steps of these beautiful, strange, detailed, lovely objects across a century. But now, in the new book, The White Road, by my guest Edmond Dewall, which is called Journey into an Obsession. This is a book about whiteness. It talks in terms that Melville speaks of whiteness. Eventually, we are told what Melville tells us, that whiteness, when it's compounded, when it's joined by evil, produces destruction. And this is a book that begins innocently enough in ancient China. In the what dynasty?
Well, it really begins in the early Sung dynasty, about 1,000 years ago. And it begins on a mountain.
And Marco Polo it is who brings porcelain to Italy and launches a worldwide obsession. Kings adore it, emperors, the great Chinese dynastics, hundreds of thousands of pieces of porcelain are made just for the convenience of the Forbidden City. 1,000 teacups and whole cities are devoted with kilns so hot, 1200 degrees, am I remembering?
You're absolutely right. So the great city of porcelain, Jingdezhen, it's said that it was like hell at night because the flames from the kilns lit up the whole sky. But by day it was worse because the smoke of the kilns made it impenetrable.
The porcelain is compounded of two different kinds of clay, both of them flaky, it seems.
It's a porcelain is made up of these two different kinds of white rock that have to be brought together in particular proportions, and each of them is susceptible to dust, becomes dust, and when you breathe this white, friable, silicaceous dust into your lungs, of course, it destroys you. It it eats you up, it silts you up like a like the mouth of a river. And so porcelain is very, very remarkably beautiful, translucent and special and light, but it also has this danger implicit in its materiality.
It's said that the kaolin that goes into porcelain is like the bone of porcelain, and the other clay, what is it called?
The pitanzi.
Is the flesh.
Yes.
So it has a bone and a flesh to hold it together, and yet it has to be, once it's molded, fused at enormously high temperatures.
At enormously high temperatures. And those high temperatures mean that, obviously, that you're dealing with kilns which are terrifying. I mean, that kind of heat is almost unimaginable to work with or be around, that kind of heat. It means lots of different things. It means that the objects that go into these great kilns are susceptible, of course, to all kinds of damage. So there's all this work often is totally destroyed, which is an interesting thing in itself. But it also means that you have to imagine the sounds of these kilns, the kind of the presence of all these enormous furnaces going night and day. It's an interesting material to write about because we're used to seeing porcelain as these remarkable, precious, expensive, connoisseurial, collected objects in museums or in collections, standing by themselves very authoritatively in museums. But for each one of those extraordinary objects, there's so many objects which haven't made it that have been broken. So each object has this sort of hinterland of loss.
And at first, you're astounded to see a base of an ancient vase on a hillside, and your guides are laughing because when you turn around, you discover the whole hillside is made of shards.
That's right.
How do you choose one to take with you?
How do you choose one? I mean, you stoop down, you pick something up, and there it is, and it feels like it's the most beautiful and special object in the world. And then there's another, and the other one is from an imperial stem cup, and it has a phoenix engraved in it. So you think that's the most incredible object, broken object you've seen, and then further beyond that is a carp carved into a bowl. So you're walking through this landscape, and it's a landscape of memory. It's a landscape that's entirely composed of people's hands and aspirations and skills, but in this great landslip of loss.
Now, from the age of five, you've been working pots. Your father took you to a night class, and you know this is a story of something innate that needs to explore its innateness. Now, what we find as Edmond de Waal travels from city to city is a story that grows darker and darker as the seeking of porcelain is to find porcelain that is white, perfectly white, glistening, shining, translucent white, and where, finally, in Germany, is porcelain made?
So you're right. It's a journey that goes through different episodes and cities, and I choose these people who to follow in particular footsteps, really follow in their footsteps, travel and walk the hills and I spent years on these particular journeys. But as you say, the journey from China and then its reiteration in Germany and in Meissen when they rediscover it at the very beginning of the 18th century, and then again in England, in English hills, with my apothecary walking the Cornish hills trying to find white clay. So all these are stories, these particular journeys. But as you say, it gets darker because unexpectedly, the journey took me to Germany in the 1930s. It unexpectedly took me to the story for the quest for perfection in the Third Reich, where, like many obsessives before him, Himmler, Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, a great porcelain lover, chooses to establish his own porcelain manufactory to make his own perfect, beautiful, translucent, glossy, white, perfect porcelain, and chooses to make it in a concentration camp.
In Dachau.
Yeah.
Yes, where both the prisoners and experts in porcelain, some prisoners survive because of their participation in this artistry, and these are made, these pieces, as gifts for the reigning officers in the SS. I'm talking right now to Edmund de Waal about his book, The White Road, Journey into an Obsession, and how, because you've got a picture in the book of Himmler presenting figurines, what look like gaudily painted figurines, to Hitler, who's looking very happily appreciative.
Yes, you've got what you've got there in that grainy black and white photograph is very extraordinary. It shows Himmler in the Chancellery in Berlin on Hitler's birthday, giving him a present of porcelain that's just been made in the concentration camp. And they're, as you say, they're figures, military figures, ersatz, 18th century figures. And there's Hitler smiling sort of avidly. You feel him rubbing his hands really over these new possessions.
His glee.
But what you've got there
It's the scariest picture I've ever seen of Hitler.
It's extraordinary because it is totally about obsession. It's about the boundlessness of obsession.
Now, you make porcelain shapes, sometimes perfect, now more and more often interestingly imperfect, what you call wonky. And what you like are the range of possibility in the shapes, in the glazes, so that you're making essentially in your own work abstractions about porcelain teacups, yes?
Yes. I mean, I've left behind the idea, the image of utility or of a particular function way behind, and for me what's left is an interior space, a volume. What has really left behind, Michael, is a breath, because of course an interior volume of a vessel is the equivalent of a held or an exhaled breath. So we may come to the relationship between vessels and words, but for me there is a profoundly abstracted feeling to these often very modest porcelain things that I make.
I saw the exhibit ongoing at the Gagosian Gallery, and I was reminded, because here some of the white porcelain is against a white background, the glazes, also white, are in different modulations. They sometimes reflect light, sometimes they have traces of gold, which in turn they reflect against their backgrounds. It's a study of invisibility in a way.
Invisibility is a very good word.
These are ghosts.
Well, they are ghosts. I mean, but what has a stronger presence than a ghost? Why wouldn't we be trying to bring ghosts into some kind of relationship with us, to kind of hold them near us? The last book that I wrote about this family, my family, and the last 150 years, was a very determined effort to try and bring back ghosts, was to try and find traces and memories and very fugitive moments of a family that had almost totally lost its history in Europe. So why then wouldn't you try with objects to try and hold that feeling of memory spatially in front of you somehow?
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Edmund de Waal about his book, The White Road, Journey into an Obsession. We'll continue after this short break.
KCRW is excited to announce the release of our very own virtual reality app, putting you inside KCRW's legendary studio. Our VR app has you front and center with a 360-degree view of some of your favorite artists performing live. Get lost in the music, download the app, and register for a KCRW cardboard headset so you can enjoy this immersive experience. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Edmund de Waal about his latest book, The White Road, Journey into an Obsession, where he traces the history of porcelain and uses it as a manifestation of his life and art. Now, we come to that dangerous idea that you are no longer making perfect objects. You're making, well, you know, the exhibition is called 10,000 Things. And you're making space fillers. If you look at one of them, it's ragged. The glaze is off. It leafs. It shows its underlayers. It's cut, but the whole placed in vitrines are articulations of space. But really, for me, what they were inhabitants of a space of their own that doesn't exist anywhere else, that is the world of Edmund de Waal.
It's called 10,000 Things, Michael, for a very strong, grounded reason. It's really the 10,000 Things brackets for John Cage, who wrote about the 10,000 things being endless possibility, endless iterative exploration of time and place and people and commonality and community that he found in all the different kinds of work he did. So you need 10,000 things rather than one thing. You need to be able to try again and try again and try again better. So there are many, many installations, and there are many vitrines, and there are many objects in this exhibition, but they all come back to this idea of that repetition is about life. It's about returning again and finding a different possibility each time you return.
And when I saw the exhibit itself, well, the book, The White Road, struck me as being written by someone who has been deeply immersed in a life of poetry as action, world action, the action of mind in the world. There are many quotes from poems, Emily Dickinson, Wallace Stevens. You like American poetry, it seems.
I love American poetry. Yes, 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 I do.
And could you be saying that what you are doing is making poetry?
I could say it. I think now that I'm in my 50s, I think I don't have to. I have to hurry up and say what I think. So yes, yes, I am making poetry. For me, the very real tension between voicing something and pausing, and breathing in and breathing out again. And objects is so apparent there. I've become clearer and clearer that there is, that's the kind of thing that I'm doing. It's not just simply and sort of banally that these are series of objects with spaces between them on shelves, like words on lines on a page, though there is that visual sort of background idea or symbolism there. It's much, much more about the breath. And the person who helped me think about this most over the last few years, after years of reading American poetry, was Celan, was Paul Celan.
Paul Celan is a poet whose parents died in the concentration camps and felt it wasn't the Adorno thing that there can be no more poetry after the concentration camp. No, he felt that there could be no more poetry in German, that the German language had to be dismantled. And in fact, once I read your book, I understood that Celan was tempering two words together, fusing them at great heat, and making shards.
Yes, yes, yes. That's a very, very strong and accurate description of the way in which his words are thrown onto the page in this jagged way. They're more exhalation or cries than lyric, and this breaking apart of the language and then putting it back together again is something that I find very powerful, and I feel is profoundly problematic and wonderful. And so Celan, who talked very beautifully in his only lecture about the moment between breathing in and breathing out, the what he called breath turn, Atemwende, this moment of spaciousness between two breaths, of being the moment of poetry. That seemed to me, that's what I want to do with making stuff.
Do you think, or let me say, I think that this making is part of destiny. I feel myself, I've been doing what I'm doing right now with you, talking to writers for 26 years, every week, learning how to talk to them, learning to talk better, not knowing how to do it, but doing it anyway. And it seems to me that that is what goes on in your work. You don't know exactly what you were doing, but you were made to do it. You are the one who is doing it, and there is no other, in a sense.
There is no other. There is no other. I mean, I've done this for such a very, very large proportion of my life. I mean, it's 45, 46 out of my 51, 52 years. So it's a very substantial part of my life. So yes, it is identity stuff. It's about very much about who I am and what I do. But there's this oddness as well for me, Michael, which is the pull towards words as well as the pull towards clay. And they don't map each other. They're not the same thing. But, when I'm writing, I do feel I'm making. And a paragraph, a sentence, a phrase, a sentence, a paragraph, a page, does feel to me very much, I'm moving my hands around as I'm talking to you because I'm trying to express the weight of the words on the page. So I do have a strong sense of the physicality of language. And, you know, that again may or may not come across But for me, that's part of what I'm trying to do.
Well, in its five parts, moving from the what feels like the beauty and eccentricity, the first section reads something like Calvino's beautiful invisible cities, where there in ancient China, it seems as if the world was made to be exquisite. And finally, we track this exquisite world into its dust-inducing, ugly death pursuit. And I felt, in a way, that the book, The White Road, by my guest Edmond de Waal, was written to attempt to rescue porcelain, to give it back a non-identity, to explore its anonymity rather than the nobility of achievement.
Absolutely. But damn it, Michael. I mean, you know, if it's been smothered in platitude, it's been smothered by connoisseurship. Porcelain is if you can think of a more deadly subject than writing about the history of porcelain, tell me it. You know, can you think of
I thought to myself, you know, what am I doing? I am in a world of porcelain, but who am I?
I mean, you know, can you think of a more airless room in which to sit than the room of surrounded by porcelain? But it's not that. It is about the cost of trying to do the impossible thing, about achieving this white thing in a world where whiteness is impossible. And then you're immediately on the whiteness of the whale, the kind of extraordinary, lyrical, incantatory, plural qualities of obsession.
Yes. I've been talking with Edmond de Waal, author of The White Road, Journey into an Obsession, published beautifully by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. Thank you, Edmond, for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. It's a huge privilege to be on your show.
It's a real pleasure to talk to you, and I'm grateful for the opportunity. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The White Road, Journey into an Obsession, at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. I hope you'll take the opportunity to visit the exhibition at the Gagosian Gallery in Beverly Hills. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Larissa McFarker is my guest.